Now we have Frank Göhmann from the University of Wuppertal, who will speak about the Hubbard chain, a paradigmatic integrable model.
Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction and also for the invitation. My talk, maybe like Nikolai Reshetykin's talk, will not be a talk on recent results, but rather a kind of lecture on, well, most of these results are very old, actually starting from the early 60s. Maybe in the end I'll show you some results which were obtained in the 90s. But the idea was, to give an introduction into this more condensed matter, like material, to string theorists and quantum field theorists. The title is rather bold. I choose paradigmatic model. What I mean by this is it is probably, at least in the context of condensed metaphysics, the model where you can find most of the articles in the archive. And also, I claim that it, in many respects, is more complicated than, say, the Heisenberg spin chain. And if you master understanding the beta ansatz of the Hubbard model, you will certainly be able to understand much more. So I plan to tell you something about the history. This is just a set of remarks which papers I consider to be helpful and important. If you want to learn something about the 1D Hubbard model, then we have a look at the Hamiltonian and at the intuitive meaning of the terms in the Hamiltonian. Then I want to spend some time to explain you the origin of this model as it arises in condensed metaphysics. This means I'll basically explain you the ideas of Hubbard. This may be helpful if you want to do calculations with this model because, well, if you have an intuition, it's always easier to do calculations. Then I'll give a few remarks on this on the strong coupling limit because this is the reason why some people in, say, your community got interested in the model. I'll make another few comments on the beta ansatz solution and then on the algebraic structure of the model. And finally, if there is time, I want to show you some results, some of my own results from the 90s, which concern the Hubbard model over the fog vacuum, which is usually not what people in condensed metaphysics are interested in, but here you're interested in, as I understood, in this, say, ferromagnetic state, and it is equivalent to the empty state in the Hubbard model. And for that, you have a lot better understanding of the algebraic structure, and you can find the quantum group symmetry realized on the space of states. And this is a Yangian symmetry. And then I'd like to give you a summary and some of the most simple but interesting open questions concerning the Hubbard model. The reason why I got invited is probably that we wrote a book on this together with Fabian Essler, Holger Frahm, Andreas Klümper, and Vladimir Kurepin. And so if you want to learn more, you may consider this thick book. Okay, some historical remarks. I divided them into physical remarks concerning the physical properties and remarks concerning the mathematical structure. The model, as you see it nowadays, was first formulated by Martin Goodsweiler and independently by John Hubbard. The reason why it's called Hubbard model and not Goodsweiler model is that Hubbard, in his paper, added much more, say, physical intuition to it, and he made some estimates about the parameters and so on. So it was more serious. Goodsweiler just introduced it ad hoc. Then the history of the 1D Hubbard model as an integrable or solvable model started in 1968 when Elliot Leeb and Fred Wu were able to solve this by beta ansatz. nowadays called coordinate beta ansatz. So they derived the beta ansatz equations, sometimes called Liebu equations in case of the Hubbard model. And with these equations, you have access to the spectrum. But of course, they are not easy to analyze. And if you want to analyze the system in the thermodynamic limit on an infinite chain, then you need to introduce, well, at least it is one approach, so-called string hypothesis. Strings here are the beta strings you heard before in other talks. And this was formulated by Minoru Takahashi in 72, and he used it to derive equations that determine the thermodynamics of the Hubbard model, so the TBA equations for the Hubbard model. But if you look at this from today's point of view, these Takahashi's equations are also the most systematic starting point for studying all elementary excitations, so the whole spectrum of the model. The next important paper, in my understanding, the next important papers came in the end 80s, early 90s, starting with Wojnarowicz's paper, who calculated the finite size corrections to the spectrum. And these were used by Holger Frahm and Vladimir Korepin in order to obtain the long-distance asymptotics of correlation functions in the generic case, which was a problem before and was a difficult problem. They solved it. Another very, a paper which I personally like very much is the work of Esler and Korepin, where they calculated the S matrix of the half-filled system and obtained a very clear picture of spin-charge separation in the Hubbard model at all energy scales. So the elementary particles in the Hubbard model, in the Bohr model, are electrons, but if you consider them at finite density, you have a completely different particle spectrum of spinless charge carriers and chargeless spin excitations. And this can be, this has been resolved in a very beautiful way, or understood in a beautiful way in this paper. Another important development from the practical point of view is the paper of Jitner, Klümper, and Suzuki, who were able to calculate the thermodynamic properties within the so-called quantum transfer matrix approach, which means that you can really get the numbers, say, for the susceptibility or for charge and spin stiffnesses at finite temperature to arbitrary accuracy now. Because in their method, you have to solve a finite number of nonlinear integral equations compared to the infinite number of linear equations in Takahashi's approach. That was the physical, about the physical properties, the mathematical structure. There, I would again suggest to put Lieb and Wu's paper at the beginning, because if you can solve a model by beta ansatz, it means it should be integrable. But the construction of the R matrix, encoding the Young-Baxter structure of the Hubbard model, came rather late, only in 86, and was done by Shastri. And the proof that this R matrix satisfies the Young-Baxter equation came even later in 95. Also, the proof that the beta ansatz eigenstates are highest weight states with respect to an SO4 symmetry came rather late. It was done in the PhD thesis of Fabian Esler, was published in 92. The reason is that such properties are usually most easily proven in the context of the algebraic beta ansatz, but in 92, the algebraic beta ansatz for the Hubbard model was not yet available. It was done only in 96 by Marcio Martins and his student Ramos. Another important piece of structure, mathematical structure in the Hubbard model, is the Yangian symmetry, which was found by Uglov and Korepin in 1994. And finally, the connection between the Yangian symmetry and Shastri's R matrix was found by Murakami and myself in 97. Okay, let's look at the Hamiltonian. The Hubbard Hamiltonian is very simple, consists of two parts. The first part is usually called the hopping part, and the second part, the Hubbard interaction. So the C is just a field operator, creation operator for a firm, C dagger is the creation operator for the fermion, and C an annihilation operator, and the operators N there stand for density. So N is C dagger C. So what we have here is, say, a free part on the lattice, and then a density-density interaction on the lattice. This is the Hubbard model for electrons. Electrons means the particles have spin up or spin down. And, well, we have to take in mind that this is a model of solid-state physics, so the Hopping integral T, little t, is of the order of 1 millielectron volt. MeV doesn't mean mega electron volt, but millielectron volt. So it's very natural that we don't have antiparticles in the systems. Okay, let's see. So usually you visualize the model by drawing some lattice, and on the lattice you have four states. A lattice site can be occupied by an electron which may have spin up or spin down. It may be empty or occupied by two electrons. And if two electrons occupy the same site, this will be punished by an energy, U is positive, then it's a punishment. And the hopping from one side to another gives you a gain in kinetic energy minus T. So the interpretation of the two parts, the Hubbard interaction and the hopping, is the following. The Hubbard interaction just counts the number of double-occupied lattice sites. So number of double-occupied lattice sites times the energy U. And the Hopping is a free fermion part. It can be diagonalized by Fourier transform, and the spectrum is just minus 2T times cosine. So different from what you use from quantum field theory, the spectrum is bounded, but not only from below, but also from above. The meaning is that this is one band in the band model of solids. The intrinsic parameter or coupling parameter here is the ratio capital U over 4T, which means the ratio of interaction strengths and bandwidths, so the difference between upper and lower edge of the dispersion here. So where does it come from? If you can look at the solid at low temperature and you start doing experiments, then you will find that there are positive ions which form a crystal lattice or regular structure. And so this lattice of ions and electrons in between is a good starting point for looking at the electronic properties of solids, a phenomenological starting point. Then you have a Hamiltonian, which is kinetic energy of electrons plus ionic potential plus the Coulomb repulsion between electrons, which is long range. And this is, of course, much different from the Hubbard model, where you have short range density-density interaction at one lattice site. So how do you get the Hubbard model out of this model? Well, if you look at this, this is a many-body problem, and most of the elementary ideas of solid-state physics come from transforming this by brute force and intuition into a one-particle problem. Then you can do many things. And but the intuition behind it is the following. Let's just assume we add and subtract an auxiliary potential VA. So that means we want to describe the interaction by some effective one-body potential. And let's plug it in artificially. Here then, the Coulomb interaction is modified by some term, 1 over n minus 1, and then you have this auxiliary potential. And then the idea is good one-body approximations can be obtained by good choice of this auxiliary potential VA, which must be chosen such that the matrix element of this interaction U between the one-body eigenstates, the eigenstates of H1, must be small. And the phenomenological idea here is the idea of screening. So, just think of you're looking at the ground states, and you add an additional charge. What does it see? It sees, well, there are already many other electrons, and they screen the interaction of the ions. And there are more systematic approaches to this called density functional theory. Anyway, so how do we come to the Hubbard model? First, we have to change the basis. The basis of the one-body Hamiltonian are the Bloch states, which means some periodic functions times the plane wave factor. They are parameterized by the lattice momentum K, which ranges inside the Brillouin zone. And instead of this, we use another basis, which is a kind of local basis, and obtained, here is the definition. You just sum over all K over the Bloch states, and then you will find that this function is localized around the lattice point at zero. And then you shift it by all possible lattice points, capital R. So this is some kind of analog of the atomic wave functions, but adapted to the lattice in such a way that they form an orthogonal or orthonormal basis. And the connection between the field operators here is just the Fourier transform. After doing this, you can represent the Hamiltonian of the electrons in the following way. You have, hopping, and you have interaction matrix elements which have many, many indices. And the indices, the Roman indices, I, J, K, L, they denote the lattice size, so the atomic orbitals in your solid. And the Greek indices denote the bands in your solid. So this is no approximation, it's just a different way of writing the Hamiltonian, but in this form you can easily discuss which interaction might be negligible or not. Just assume that all of the U parameters, the interaction parameters, can be neglected, then you have a pure one-body problem, and this is called the bent model of solids. And this is used by many experimentalists. So then, on the other hand, U is the screened interaction. So if you choose your auxiliary potential appropriately, then it will be short range. And the most simple short range approximation is just the range is so short that you only have intra-atomic Coulomb repulsion. And if there is, if there is the Fermi surface is inside a single band, then you may also neglect the band indices and you have arrived at the Hubbard model. So the Hubbard model is some, sketchy way of taking into account the Coulomb interaction in solids. The most simple, minimal model of taking into account the screen Coulomb interaction in solids. That's the Hubbard model, physical medium. And the applications are applications to electronic properties of solids with narrow bands, then to magnetism, ferromagnetism of iron, cobalt, nickel, and maybe most important nowadays to the mod metal insulator transition. Okay, the strong coupling descendants. So this is how the Hubbard model appeared in the context of gauge theory. And what is that? If you look at the Hubbard model, then you can, and in the case that the on-site repulsion U is much larger than the hopping, then you can do perturbation theory around Tij equal to zero. But then the spectrum of the other part of the interaction part is very simple. As I said, this part counts the number of double occupied sites. If you have L lattice sites, then the energy level suggests 0, U, 2U, and so on, and the highest level is L times U, and these levels are macroscopically degenerate. If you switch on the hopping, then the levels will split off, and you obtain the strong coupling descendants of the Hubbard model by looking at the lowest level and writing down an effective Hamiltonian that describes the splitting of this lowest level. So how many states do you have there? As I said, you have locally four possibilities, whole to two electrons or one electron will spin up or spin down. And if you have no double occupation, you have only three possibilities, a hole or spin up and spin down electron. So this gives you, well, you can put the electrons, say n electrons on L side, so L over n, and then you have two possibilities for each, so times 2n. This is the dimension of the space of states. And in particular, if n is equal to L, this is called half filling, because you have half as many electrons in the system as are allowed, then the number of states is 2 to the n, which is the dimension of the Hilbert state of the Heisenberg spin chain. Okay? That's why the spin chain occurs at half filling. In the more general case that n is smaller than L, you find some model which is called sometimes called the TJ model, which can be expressed in terms of Fermi operators, spin operators S, which are just combinations of Fermi operators so folded with a Pauli matrix. And you see that n here, this operator n, which you have in the first line, is working? Well, this n is the particle number operator, local particle number operator. So it counts the numbers of particles at site j. So if all sites are occupied, you get the 1 here. So this vanishes, this is 0, and this is 0, and you end up with the Heisenberg spin chain. And so why is this remarkable? This is remarkable because... an electromagnetic field couples as a gauge field to the field operator. So this means effectively it couples to the Hopping matrix elements, which get a phase. But here in this effective spin model, the Hopping matrix elements appear only as a modular square. So if you add a phase here, nothing will change. So it means in this approximation, the model at half filling does not react to an external electromagnetic field. It means it is an insulator. And this is what people mean by Mott insulator, an interaction-induced transition from conducting to an insulating model. You have to keep in mind at U equals zero, the model is surely a conductor. So something must happen between U equals zero and U equal to infinity. Okay. So maybe I can only finish my first part of my talk. Very unfortunate situation. So from this strong coupling, you can get some systematic picture of integrable models connected to the Hubbert model. You start with the Hubbert model, do large U second order perturbation theory, you get the TJ model as I showed you. This model is not integrable. But if you specify it to half filling, you get the spin chain Hamiltonian, Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which is integrable. If you just take the first order term, you get an integrable model, which in a sense is a variant of a free fermion model. And if you neglect the three side terms here, you get something which is also called the TJ model, and at a special value of coupling, you have a GL21 symmetry. This is why this is called supersymmetric TJ model, which is again integrable. And all of these models are related in the way I showed you to the Hubbert model. So strong coupling perturbation theory beyond second order was the thing people here are interested in. And this was also done in solid state physics, actually. And the reason for that is that, of course, because you have a smaller Hilbert space, this gives you simplification. And the people were particularly interested in it in D equal 2 and 3, not so much in one dimension, because in one dimension we had the exact solution by beta on that. And the second reason why people got interested in that is that it is relevant for applications in real materials where we are often in the strong coupling case. Okay, there is another application I'd like to mention briefly, was done by Takahashi. So if you go one order higher in the half-filled case, then you find the ground state energy can be expressed in terms of correlation functions of the Heisenberg chain. And well, since the states that say, well, one order determine the matrix elements at one order higher in perturbation theory, you can express the ground state energy here in terms of ground state correlation functions of the Heisenberg XXX chain, and you have two contributions, one from the next from the neighbors, and but one from the next to nearest neighbors here. This is this J plus two. And then comparing with the expansion of the known ground state energy of the Hubbard model, you find this nice result for the next to nearest neighbor neighbor correlation function, which contains theta of 3. And this was actually the starting point of this observation for the work of Bose-Kurepin and Jimbo and co-workers to reconsider, well, this observation. This was a challenge. And they reconsidered the problem of correlation function within the context of the Q-Knishn examological equation because of this. So let's have a brief look at the Beta-Ansatz solution. There's one thing I want to tell you, because in the first talk we had this picture of Beta-Ansatz completely based on the idea of two-particle scattering. If you follow these recipes in the Hubbard model, then you will find, for example, that if you replace the SU2 electrons, or electrons who spin up and spin down, by some three-flavor electrons, then you get the same beta, and thus everything works through, but you find the result is wrong. And this is actually a rather famous mistake made by Haldane. So the message here is, with the Beta-Ansatz solution, there also comes a wave function, and you have to look at the wave function, and you have to satisfy the symmetries of the wave function. In this case, it must be anti-symmetric. And for the Hubbard model, the anti-symmetry of the wave function, psi, together with the factorization of two particles scattering, this gives you the Beta-Ansatz, not only the one thing. And another thing you get, of course, well, this is the wave function, and then you get the Beta-Ansatz equations, which can be used to calculate properties related to the spectrum, so the energy. And everything which you can get of the energy, like, for example, finite size corrections of the ground state energy and other things. So this is what you usually can get from a Beta-Ansatz. Properties of the system relating to the spectrum. And this is basically done for the Hubbard model, I would say. This was investigated very carefully because you have applications. It was done by many, many people. But on the other hand, you have information contained in the wave function. And since the coordinate Beta-Ansatz wave function is very complicated, this has not been exploited. Even in the algebraic Beta-Ansatz, it is very difficult to find out local properties of the system, as you could learn from Jean-Michel Maillet's talk. Yeah. The only information which was obtained from the Beta-Ansatz wave function in case of the Hubbard model was the highest weight property of the wave function, which, as I said, was obtained by Fabian Essler and Kurepin and Schautens, which is nevertheless an important information, because this information, you can argue that the Beta-Ansatz is complete. You can't state. Another information which is only conjectural is the formula for the norm of the Beta-Ansatz wave functions. So, how many minutes do I have?
15.
Oh, still 15? I thought I started earlier.
You started 25.
Oh, okay. That's good. Then I can just proceed. So, since the coordinate Beta-Ansatz wave function is a difficult object, and it is not appropriate for extracting say, local information about local quantities of the system, one would like to have an algebraic beta ansatz. And let me tell you something about the status of the algebraic beta ansatz of the Hubbard model. Yes, and also about the difficulties. For the Hubbard model, the understanding is not as complete as for the spin chains, even on the level of the algebraic beta ansatz. So first of all, well, the method, the algebraic approach, which was invented in the school of Fadeev in the late 80s, is based on what is now called the Young-Wechsler algebra. So you have this relation RTT equal TTR, which means this is a short form for writing all commutation relations between the generators of some algebra, which are comprised in the matrix, so T, J, K. And this T1, T2, for example, is just a way of writing all possible products of matrix elements of T of lambda and T of mu. Okay? You write all possible products and then some relation which explains you how to change the order. This is the R matrix, and it has some similarity with the structure constants in the Lie algebra. Okay, and then if you multiply this equation by R inverse from the right and take the trace and use that, the trace of a tensor product is the product of the traces, then you find that the so-called transymmetric, so the trace of T of lambda commutes with the trace of T of mu. This means you have found generating functions of, say, integrals of motion. And then if your system has a classical limit, as was explained by Nikolai Rysitykin, then you have Liouville theorem, and these commutators turn into Poisson brackets. And Liouville's theorem says, well, it is, in a sense, it is constructive. So it says that the system can be integrated by quadratures. So it can be solved up to the inversion of integrals. But in quantum mechanics, we don't have a Liouville theorem. So you need a different device to obtain the information you need. And this device is encoded in the commutation relations in this RTT equal TTR. Well, this is like for the harmonic oscillator, where you have just A dagger and A. The Hamiltonian itself is just A dagger and A, but in order to diagonalize this, you use the commutation relation between A and A dagger. And this is some additional, this is also some kind of quadratic algebra, some additional information which you need, which is in here. Okay, so the R matrix should satisfy the Young-Wechsler equation, as you probably know, and then you can construct an L matrix, a monodomy matrix. We saw that several times, so I don't want to repeat this. There is some systematic way you can of deriving higher conserved quantities. Just take the logarithm of inverse of the shift operator times the transfer matrix and expand this around the shift point. Shift point is the point where the transfer matrix itself becomes the shift operator U. So at this shift point, log U to the minus 1 T is equal to 0. And then in the next orders you get, then there's the theorem of Lüscher actually, that in the next orders you get local operators in the sense 2-side, 3-side, 4-side, and so on. And you can compute them. There are formula for that. There's not a general one, but you can do it one by one. And the first one gives you the Hamiltonian. And if you look at the second formula, this gives you a criterion of integrability. If you expect the R matrix of difference form, it means if you expect that it depends on the difference of the two parameters, then you will find that well, under the other conditions that we have, the initial condition that R at the shift point is equal to P, then you find that this second derivative of the R matrix and the H squared term cancel, and this means that this the second integral of motion is just the sum over the commutators. So this means this should commute with the Hamiltonian. So you have a local criterion of testing as integrability in a certain sense. You can test if there exists an R matrix which is of difference form. And for the Hubbard model, this test fails. And this is one of the reasons why it is more difficult to do the algebraic beta analysis. Finally, an R matrix was found by Shastri. The first thing is, it is big. You have four states per side, so you have four times four. You have to have a 4 × 4 × 4 × 4, so 16 × 16 matrix. And moreover, the Boltzmann weights in here, they cannot be of difference form. Okay? But nevertheless, they are explicitly known. Here is a list. Don't look at it. It is just, they are given. It can be written as, say, rational combinations of cosine and sine of parameters lambda and mu. But there are two other parameters, L and H, which appear here in exponential functions. But L and H and lambda and mu are not independent, but connected by a constraint. So if you analyze this, then this means even if, say, you set mu equal to 0 and consider the R matrix just as a function of lambda, then you don't, first of all, you don't have a uniform parameterization, but even if you set, say, one of the parameters equal to 0 and then you test using the Riemann-Hurwitz formula, if you can uniformize the Boltzmann rays on one parameter, you find, well, this guy lives on the Riemann surface of genus 3, so it's not so simple. It has been constructed by gluing together two free fermion R matrices, which are very simple, but the procedure of gluing makes it difficult. So, in other words, Shastri's R matrix is not a very convenient tool for calculations. The algebraic beta ansatz, which has been constructed by Martins, is partially conjectural. So he just, you have to do something like showing cancellation of unwanted terms, and he did this only for examples, n equal 2. N equal 3, he says he did it by Mathematica. I believe him. But I tried to check it. Probably it is right, but it is not a mathematical proof. That's what I want to say. And I think if you do the mathematical proof, you will gain insight about the structure. Nevertheless, the result was very useful because if you have the R matrix, you don't have only the Hamiltonian. You can construct a vertex model connected with the Hubbard model. And if you can do that, you can also construct another vertex model, which is called which is constructed out of so-called quantum transfer matrix. It's an auxiliary vertex model which generates the thermodynamics of the Hubbard model. Then it's like doing analytically a path integral. That's the idea. And this was done by Jutna, Klümper, Suzuki. Another benefit of this construction was the construction of a boost operator, which is a generator of conserved quantities here, which was done by John Links and co-workers in 2001. Then another application, which probably I don't show you, but I plan to show you, is the clarification of the role of the Yang-Yen. And the last one is you can use it to generalize it to higher rank. This was done by some people like Masarani. Martins was also involved. I forgot to cite him here, and then some Chinese colleagues, Yue and a student of him. So let's see, how many? 5 minutes? So then maybe I can briefly tell you something about the Yang-Yen symmetry. So first of all, if you want to deal with the Hubbard model, you have to realize you want to deal with electrons. So this requires to introduce a grading into your system. So the grading is convenient to take plus, minus, minus, plus grading. And then in your RTT relation, you have to use a graded tensor product. Furthermore, it's convenient to divide your monodromy matrix, which is 4×4, into 4 4×4 blocks. Well, the blocks are a little bit asymmetric. In the middle of matrix A, then, this is what you see there. Okay. So There is a possibility to go to the infinite volume, to do the thermodynamic limit on the level of operators. This was actually the starting point of the quantum inverse scattering method. So this was what Fadeev, I think, originally intended, and what he actually presented in the work with Sklyanin in 78. You can do that if your vacuum is trivial. I mean, if your vacuum is the Fock vacuum, then you can regularize the whole structure on the level of operators. So maybe I can't explain you the details now. I can, if you're interested, I can explain it later in private. The point is that when you regularize T, at the same time you change your RTT relation. The reason for that is that you have to regularize T and the RTT relation independently, because if you take the ground state expectation value of the of T times T, this is not the same as the ground, as the product of ground state expectation values of T's because of normal ordering. And this changes your R, and it turns out it simplifies your R. And then for this, well, for the new T, you have some kind of integral representation, some formula where you can compute it term by term. And the regularized RTT relations, in these regularized RTT relations, you find that the submatrix A decouples from the rest of the algebra. This is a very amazing observation. And moreover, if you introduce a change of variables, which is given here, non-trivial change of variables, which was found by Martins, then this submatrix in the decoupled sector, little r, has a rational parametrization and is the R matrix of the XXX chain, which is amazing. Well, this means that if you look at the expansions, at the coefficients in the expansion with respect to 1 over V, you find the generators of a Yangian there, a representation of the Yangian. This is the way the Yangian is generally constructed, so must be a representation of the Yangian. And on the other hand, you obtain the center by expanding the quantum determinant of this matrix about the same point, infinity. If you do that for the Heisenberg chain, you find some trivial center. It's just numbers. But in this case, the center contains the Hubbard Hamiltonian, which explains why it is Yangian symmetric. Okay, so, and from the construction, you can, of course, calculate the representation. You get explicit expressions for the Yangian generators, of course, for the Hamiltonian, which we knew before. And then you can look at the other elements, not the A's, but there were B's and C's, and the B's and C's have the meaning of creation operators. If you normalize them, just following the same predictions, prescriptions, of Fadeev and Sklyanin, so normalized by the inverse of some other operator, then you find a representation of the, you find creation operators in which build a representation of a graded Fadeev homologic of algebra. And in contrast to many field theoretical calculations, here the representation is explicitly constructed. So you know what FA like Fadeev and ZA like Zamolodchikov is. So you have two such algebras, one coming from B, the other from C. And here are the commutation relations for Fadeev Zamolodchik of algebra. And that's the one thing. And the other thing, I'll finish this in a minute. The other thing is you can also calculate the commutation relations with the Yangian. And if you know something about Yangian, if you look at these formula, and if you know that the J0 annihilates the vacuum, then you see that these F's generate an evaluation representation. So if you have two particles, then you have a tensor product of evaluation representations. So all the states are Yangian multiplets, in other words. And you can also consider bound states and the commutation relations. Then from RTT equal TTR, you get the S matrix or the bare bound states, and you find that they are Yang-Yang singlets, all of these long strings. So since my time is over, I should better conclude. I call this talk the Hubbard model, paradigmatic integrable model. Probably it's mostly paradigmatic model because its importance in condensed metaphysics. It allows us to understand why most of our materials where correlations play a role are anti-ferromagnets. The reason is because U is the remainder of the Coulomb repulsion, so it's positive. And if you look at the formula for the effective spin chain Hamiltonian, it's proportional to U times some other positive number. So it induces anti-ferromagnetic exchange. So the Hubbard model allows us to understand why most of the materials are anti-ferromagnets in nature, and allows us to understand the existence of the Mott transition. Well, then, as I wanted to say, most of the properties relating to the spectrum have been obtained, but there are open questions. One is, one should certainly work on simplifying and completing the algebraic beta ansatz for the Hubbard model. We would like to have a better understanding of the structure of Shastri's R matrix. For example, is there a generalization in which it would appear more natural, maybe in which you could have better intuition about what it means. And there is actually a nice generalization of the Hubbard Hamiltonian formed by Alcaraz and Baryev. And for this model, there is no R matrix known at all. And the R matrix of this model should generalize Shastri's R matrix. And then another interesting question is the role of the Yang-Yang symmetry at finite density, for example, at half filling. It would be very interesting to find out, but I don't know how this could be done. Thank you very much.
Thank you for this very nice talk. Are there questions?
The Yang-Yang symmetry generalized for five dimensions. The Yang-Yang symmetry of the Hubbard model, is it realized for a finite length?
No, it is not. That's why we had to do this limit. Yes. Mm-hmm. But there is a long-range version of this Hubbard model, which also has Yang-Yang symmetry on a finite chain. This was actually shown by myself and Ino Zemtsev in 96.
Okay. More questions? Okay, if not, then let's thank Frank again.
I think there was...
This may be a silly question, but are there any bosonic generalization of the Hubbard model that are integrable? Well, instead of fermions, you have bosons.
No, if you just replace the fermions by bosons...
Well, not in... No, some generalizations using bosons that are Hubbard-like.
Well, it depends on what you call Hubbard-like. If you're generous, then they are. If you're not generous, they aren't. I can explain you what, maybe in private, what exists.
Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.